This is the 1895 podcast, official podcast of Shelburne FC, bringing you news, views and interviews from inside Tolka Park, Dublin's finest since 1895. Here's your host, Stephen Duty.
Mr. Gary Brown, you are very welcome to the 1895 podcast. Thanks for coming on, and how are you keeping?
I'm great, and thanks for having me. It's great to be on, and thanks for all the great work you guys do. Really appreciate it. As I say, Stephen, it's great to be here, and thank you very much.
We are here to talk about Ollie, One Love, One Life. It's a one-man show. It's coming up in May, Saturday, May the 17th, and Sunday, May the 18th. We will dive into the show itself shortly, but I think it's important that people get a feel for you, Gary. So tell us, you were telling me the other day, you're steeped in Shelburne, so tell the listeners how it all started for you.
Yeah, well, first of all, my father was a docker. My father was killed in the docks in an accident on the docks. But I'm sure you're aware of the history of Shelburne being from Ringsend. The dockers had a great love for different sports, football being one of them, boxing and rowing being the others. And the dockers teams were always either Shamrock Rovers or Shelburne. And I was lucky my father was a Shells fan. So I got kind of steeped in that. He used to bring me to games when I was a kid. I still have a programme from 1963, would you believe, which is the famous game when the Cup Winners' Cup when Shelburne played Barcelona in Dalymount. I was only a really small kid on my father's shoulders. I was 4 or 5. I don't remember a thing about the match. I just remember the lights. The floodlights and kind of falling asleep halfway through it, but I was only very, very young. But so yeah, and then I played. Although my father's family originally are from South Dock, but we then kind of his mother married somebody, and then we ended up living in Cabra. I'm originally from Church Street. That's where we moved to first, and then we moved to Cabra. But he remained working on the docks until he was killed, and they were always my team as a kid. And I played my soccer, my schoolboy football with Cambridge boys in Ringsend, and I ended up signing for Shelburne just after we'd won the FA Youth Cup in 1977, I think it was. So I signed for Shells and made my debut for Shells in a Leinster Senior Cup game against Shamrock Rovers. I think I was about 17, 17 and a half. So I played with Shells. Now, I don't profess to ever been a great footballer, but I did play with Shells for a while and got a couple of runs at the first team and managed to play with the great Jimmy Johnson from Celtic because Shells brought him over to play. So I'm kind of steeped in Shelburne. And then many years later, when I set up my own business, Ollie Byrne, being a great man for always keeping an eye on how we could generate more funds, tapped into me and asked me to, would I join the board? And the chairman at the time was a great, great man called Finbar Flood, who was ex-chief executive of Guinness. And he was a former footballer. He played in golf for Shells as well. And I joined the board for a while. And then Finbar, after a couple of years, said, look, I've been doing this for a while. Would you mind stepping in? So I stepped in as chairman, and I was chairman of the club for 3 years. And I remember the first challenge I had, apart from having to deal with Ollie on a regular basis, was we drew Glasgow Rangers in the UEFA Cup. And it was the time of the peace process negotiations. And the government, the Irish government, decided that they didn't want Rangers fans coming down to Dublin potentially to cause trouble because the negotiations, the peace process was a very delicate stage. So they, through the FAI, and of course the FAI kowtowed down to the government as they would. We were denied a home game against Rangers and we had to go and play an away game in Prenton Park. In Tranmere Rovers ground, which means it actually cost the club a lot of money, but we were compelled to do it. So that was kind of my first job, major job, was getting that through and making sure we got through that game unscathed. And you might remember, Stephen, I don't know if you're old enough, but we were at one stage we were beating Rangers 3-0.
Oh, I've seen all the videos.
And we ended up getting beaten 5-3. But, you know, we had gave away two penalties. But look, they were really good. It was your man, Dick Advocaat's first job as manager of Rangers, and they had a great team. They had Gattuso playing for them. They had a lot of Italian internationals. But look, we were beating them 3-0 at nearly at half time. So there you go. So that's how I ended up. So that's my connection with Shells. I've always been a fan. I still go to the games, not as regularly as I used to, but I did spend 3 years as chairman, and it was enjoyable and frustrating all at the same time. We managed to win the double for the first time in the club's history when I was chairman, so I'm kind of proud of that. And we managed to make some inroads into Europe.
Which
So
I
that's
think is
my
what everyone wants nowadays is that inroad into Europe. So I do want to ask you just around Ollie himself, because obviously the show is based around Ollie. How was he at that stage, as you mentioned, dealing with Rangers and I mean the peace process, and it was a very, very tense time. You're probably more worried about Ollie than anyone else, I'd say, among it all, are you?
I was, because and this is actually in the play. We were summoned to the then Taoiseach's house, Bertie Ahern, round in St. Luke's. And Ollie was a great man for malapropisms, getting words mixed up. You know, so you had to watch him all the time. I remember one particular time, and again, this is all in the play, in the show, which is play. He's played. Ollie is played by Gary Cook, the Opry match actor. And now he doesn't do it. He does a fair impersonation of Ollie, but it's not based around him impersonating Ollie. It's really about telling Ollie's life story and all of the ups and downs of being involved with the club. But yeah, first thing he said to me was, I came in one day into the office and he says, "I have a letter here from the FAI and they're saying we can't play Rangers." And I don't believe them, because I think they're all illegitimate. None of them can write, you know. So that was it. And he wasn't half wrong. I mean, that was kind of a nice, clever use of the word illegitimate. He meant to say illiterate, but I knew what he meant. And then he said to me that we have to go to see the Taoiseach, because the Taoiseach wanted the curry flavour with him. So there you go. But anyway, we went round and we met Bertie Ahern, and Bertie told us under no circumstances could we play the game. And Ollie erupted, so I had to kind of control Ollie and keep him calm. But we managed to do that. And I think Bertie said he'd look after us in some way. And I think he helped to fund that stand, which nobody can use anymore. But that's another story.
Funny how that one worked out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it all worked out in the end. Yeah, more, yeah. But anyway, yeah. So yeah, no, he was an incredible character, and it's a story that needed to be told. That's why I wrote the thing, you know. It was, I mean, people forget that we were so close to qualifying for the Champions League proper. And this was before anybody else did it. This is before Rovers and Dundalk and all of those things. Yeah. I mean, we were lucky in that we drew Deportivo La Coruña, who the previous year had been in the semi-final of the Champions League. They were beaten by Porto, who then went on to win it. And we drew them, and we played them in Dublin, and it was nil all in Lands End Road. It was a great crowd at the game, and we played really well. We were a really good side. Pat Finlay was a smart manager, you know. And we were playing away, and, you know, if we got a goal, they had to get two. Because it was away goals, and that time, that match would have put us into the Champions League stages, and that would have meant £8 million to the club back then. That was a huge amount of money. That's an amount of money that would have been transformative to the club, you know. Back then,
I think poor Jason Byrne's name always comes up in that game. He obviously missed the chance in the first half, and like you still look back at it now and say, like, how everything would have panned out so differently had it gone on the line that game.
Exactly. And to think that we were, like, we held them for 155 minutes of football, they didn't score. And they were getting, I was in the director's box in La Coruña, and they were getting so frustrated and so annoyed, because they had spent a lot of money, as you do, to try and do better again in the Champions League. And if we'd have scored, they had to score too. And you know, eventually our fellas got tired, as you do, and they started, they were getting so frustrated, they reverted to a long ball. It was a long ball from the goalkeeper after Jason, I think, missed, unfortunately for Jason, he missed that chance in the 6 yard box, I think in the second half actually, and straight at the keeper, and then the keeper caught it and kicked it long. The ball bounced over, unfortunate bounce over on Heary's head, and this guy, I can't remember his name, but he went on and scored. And even when he scored, we were kind of saying, well, that's okay, because if we get a goal, they have to get another one. So it was no panic. But then again, 10 minutes later, they scored again, and that was kind of it. That was it. The game was up and the dream was over. But we came so close. And a lot of people forget that. And I want to make sure that people don't forget that. And the play is about that. The whole play is that this man devoted his life to one thing. Remember, he didn't have a wife, didn't have a girlfriend, didn't have a car. Didn't have a house. And everything he did for the club. Now, he got up to some unbelievably silly things and stupid things, but he also did some genius things. I mean, this is in the play. You might remember in 1975, 2 years before I started playing, George Best was signed by Cork Celtic. And they, at the time, the home team got the gate, and the away team didn't get anything. So they only signed Best for the home games, because they knew if they brought him over for the away games, first of all, they'd have to pay him and the home team would get the gate, so they didn't bother. And Ollie found out about this and he thought that George Best would be a great draw in Dublin. And we were playing the Harold's Cross at the time. So we got on to Cork and he said, look, we'll pay George Best wages to play against us. Right? So he... We you know, and it was advertised. George Best played in Harold's Cross. 6,000 people showed up. We beat them 2-1 or 2-0, I can't remember. And we made a financial killing out of it. And Ollie said that was the first time that a team had paid an opposition player's wages. And as he said himself, it was unparalleled in the history of football. So, yeah, but he also, Ollie was steeped in Chelsea because his father was involved in the club as well. His father was secretary, and you might remember there was actually at one stage they tried to build a stadium in Ringsend. It's still, I think there's, say, Pat CY playing it now, but it was started, but they never really got it covered through lack of money. So his father was steeped in the club as well, and Ollie always wanted to try and do something to prove his father, because Ollie studied law for 2 years, but jacked it up. And the father got so annoyed he threw him out of the house, you know. And Ollie was always trying to, you know, it's kind of a universal theme in that the play, in that every club probably has somebody like Ollie, who's completely and utterly devoted to it. And it consumes their life. And then there's the other universal theme of, you know, some people are always trying to prove their father right. So there's those two teams running through the play. There's a lot of humour in the play. There's lots of stories that some of the things that Ollie, I'm not going to give them all away because people won't go, but there's funny things that Ollie got up to, you know. And yeah, so I just thought it was a story that had to be told because he was so close. So close. Now, Ollie is Marmite. Some people love him, some people hate him. And that's the way it is. But he was just an interesting character, you know.
And I wanted to ask this, but I think I might know the answer before I ask. What was Ollie, or was there even an Ollie Byrne away from Shells? Like, what was he like when you weren't specifically dealing with Shells business with him?
There wasn't. Is the answer, Stephen?
That's what I was expecting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how he was. I mean, it was just all Shelbourne, morning, noon and night. He was consumed by the whole thing. He never really had an interest in anything else. Now, he at one stage he did manage bands when he left when he sort of jack up law school. But then he got involved in he had a shop in Ringsend called Beanie and Barney's, which mysteriously, I think, went on fire in the end. But anyway, he was importing cigarettes, and he was bringing them from across the border, and he got caught doing that, and he had to spend some time in Shelton Abbey. Again, that's in the play, and it's a funny story about that. There was a Shergar, a horse, was involved, but you know, that's another story. But so yeah, he was just became consumed by it, You know, there was nothing else to him other than that. Anything he wanted, the only thing he wanted was success for Shelbourne. The only thing he ever did was, how am I going to pay the wages this week? How am I going to get money for the players? You know, I used to say that if you were like, and he was a very generous man in lots of ways. He helped out an awful lot of people. He helped out an awful lot of players and their children, even, you know, and even some other guys used to hang around the club. But I used to say that, you know, if you fell into the canal and you were drowning, Ollie would run over and he'd say, "Have you got a fiver? I need to pay me to pay a player." And once you got to get him the fiver, then he'd help you. You know what I mean? The first thing was, how can I get money out of this to pay the players? You know, that was him.
And just on the show itself, the play itself, when did you start thinking you wanted to put it on stage?
About 5 years ago, I wrote my first play called Back Live 7 years ago, and I put that on and it was relative success with a black comedy. Then I wrote another one, and I just got thinking of what any ideas. And I said, there has to be a play in Ollie because he's such a character, you know. And then I started writing it and doing research because, you know, I had to do research on lots of different things about him. And I interviewed, you know, players. I spoke to players. I spoke to ex-managers.
Gary, you obviously knew Ollie personally. Do you feel like that put more pressure on you putting the show together?
I suppose yes and no, Stephen, in that I first met him when I was 17, 18, when I was starting to play for Shells, and he was kind of in the background there. And then he kind of came to more prominence later on. Then he asked me back to come back as to help out. So I did, and I got to know him as best you can. I mean, you asked a question earlier on about, you know, was there more to Ollie than you know, the Shelbourne thing? And really, really there wasn't. You know, that's the interesting thing, is he never really spoke to him about anything else other than Shelbourne and the football and the machinations he was having with the FAI and the state of the game and things like that. He never really revealed much about his inner self. So to say, was he a friend of mine? I'm not sure, because I was fond of him, but I didn't know enough about him really. Even though you might think that's strange, having written a play, I still believe I've written a play about Ollie the Shelbourne man. I'm not sure I've written a play about Ollie the inner man, if you know what I mean. But what I have managed to do is I have made a connection with him and his father that I think is something that probably, you know, was a deep feeling. And I'm kind of leveraging off that a little bit, you know, the relationship he had with his dad. And obviously, you know, the relationship he had with Shelbourne, because Shelbourne, to a degree, it was his wife, it was his girlfriend, it was his love. Hence the title, you know, One Love, One Life. He only had one love in his life, as far as I could see, and that was Shelbourne Football Club. Obviously, he loved his mum and his dad earlier on, but later on, his one love was Shelbourne Football Club, and he only had one life, and all his life was devoted to that one love, you know.
Yeah, you mentioned the title there. Like, it's so, the show is just based around Ollie. Did, like, Ollie, his mannerisms, like, everyone, I was only around Ollie a couple of times, but he does leave that kind of lasting impression on you, even as a young lad. Like, he would have known my dad more so. And you do find yourself kind of looking up at this guy being like, he's something very unique about him, but is that a hard thing? I know you mentioned, you know, especially with Gary Cook, it's not, he doesn't play Ollie as such. It's more about Ollie's story. But is that a difficult thing to kind of, you know, you're using obviously a bit of creative license, but you do, I'm sure, want to keep it as close to real life as it was.
Yeah, well, I think that's a really interesting point. First of all, when I was looking to get an actor to play him, I thought it was important that I got someone who actually knew Ollie and had met Ollie. And fortunately enough, Gary had, because we used to run fundraising lunches for the club, and Apre Match used to perform at it after we'd have guest speakers. Like, we had people like Alex Ferguson and Alan Hansen and people like that. And so he got to know Ollie. So it was important that I got someone who knew Ollie. Also, while I said to you that it's not a direct impression of him, he does portray Ollie quite well, some of the mannerisms, but you can't keep that mannerism up all the time, if you know what I mean. It's very difficult because then it just becomes almost a parody, a comedy. I didn't want it to be that way. Now, it is funny. There's lots of funny bits in it because Ollie's life was funny, and sometimes not down to himself. It's just the way he carried on in terms of, and I mentioned malapropisms and getting words mixed up, but that was there all the time, you know. So we're trying to balance getting the story, but the story is about Ollie Bourne's fascination and only devoting his whole life to one cause, and that was a football club, with the shadow of his father in the background behind him, and him always kind of wanting to please that. And there's really funny instances. There's the instance of when he was smuggling cigarettes. There's the stuff about the FAI writing letters to him and how he would deal with them. There's instance with Pads Athletic when the leg of his trousers went on fire. I don't know if you're in that particular instance.
No, I have heard about it though.
I was there in Richmond Park when they threw a flare at him and he tried to put it out and the leg of his trousers caught fire. Now, I'm not going to reveal what happened, but that was something that was just a sight to be. And we try and portray that in the play, you know. So if you like, the setting of the play is it's when I went to see Ollie when he was dying. He was diagnosed with a brain tumor. The brain tumor was getting significantly worse. And it was a kind of a quick demise in the end. But I went to see him in the hospice and he was sitting in a wheelchair. And he was dressed in a suit and he had a Shelburne shirt and tie on and his sandals. So you can imagine, you know, he always used to wear pinstripe suits with sandals, which was kind of a bit jarring, to say the least. But anyway, I went to see him and he was sitting down. And when I went in first, he didn't really recognise me because of obviously the tumour. And then I started talking to him and took about 10, 15 minutes. And then just all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he said, "Do you remember the time that we..." And off he went. And he burst into the story as if I, you know, he knew all along. And then after a while, he relapsed into, again, just this shell of a man staring out the window. So I kind of compared it to like being, like you're playing a CD and there's gaps in the CD. And the CD is whirling around and every now and again, it comes to a bit, there's no gap on, and the music plays, and that was Ollie. So what we have is we've set him up as, you know, when you come to see him, he's sitting in the wheelchair in the hospice, but he then every now and again becomes back to the real Ollie, and he bursts out of the chair and starts, you know, becoming Ollie again, you know. And it's a series of him going back in and out of the chair to reveal stories in his life. Some of which are quite funny, I can tell you that. So that's what it is. There's a lot of storytelling and drama and fun in this, but it's also the undercurrent message that Shelburne got so close one time to breaking through that, you know, the glass ceiling of Europe. Other clubs have been trying ever since and have been successful, but we got so close, and it was because of Ollie's kind of tunnel vision. Now, having said that, he obviously borrowed money he shouldn't have, and probably off people he shouldn't have, and ultimately, because it didn't work, it ended up putting the club back into a bad place. But having said that, he did try, and he got very close, you know.
He did. Look, when Ollie Bourne's name comes up, Gary, obviously, from a Shelburne perspective, everyone automatically wants to hear it. I'd even say from a League of Ireland perspective, I think, look, Ollie was one of those characters. I mean, so goes to saying, hated or adored, he was never ignored. But do you think, you mentioned already that there's obviously the Shelburne relationship in the show. There's also Ollie's relationship with his dad. Do you think that opens it up a little bit more to maybe just outside that football sphere of audience?
I think it does, yeah. I think it's a universal story in sons trying to prove their father or you know, prove themselves in front of their father, particularly if their father is dead. I have that myself. So I kind of identified it because I lost my father when I was very young. And any of the success I've achieved in my life, my wife even says to me, you know, would you not enjoy it? And I'm kind of thinking, yeah, I am enjoying it, but at the same time, the man I really wanted to see this the most is not there, you know? And I think there's a, I think that's a kind of a universal theme with people who lost their loved ones at an early age, and particularly their parents, because they feel, you know, I've been lucky, or I've worked hard and I've achieved this, but really the people I wanted to see, you know, they're not there. And so I think that adds a little bit of well, how you could say, you know, lifescapes to it. You know, it kind of puts another thread through it that kind of gets it away from football. But ultimately, it's a football story like no other. That's what I describe it as, and it is this dedication of, you know, one love, one life. I'm only going to get one go at this, and I'm going to do everything I possibly can to make this dream come true. And it was Europe. He says even in the play, you know, at times, I'm not going to quote it directly, but, you know, yeah, other teams win leagues, but for us it's Europe, you know. He wanted to be the first, you know. And he says things like, you know, Dublin is as big as Glasgow, you know, and Manchester, and Matt Busby could do it, and Jock Stein could do it, why can't we do it, you know?
It's just that I'm sitting here now, I cannot wait. It sounds like it just drags everything together, and it's whether it's the ugly side of things or the positive side of Ollie. What I do want to ask you is, you mentioned about you did your research, you spoke to managers, players, plenty of people, a wide spread of people. Was it difficult to decide on what could go in and what couldn't? Look, I'm sure along your research, I'm sure you heard some mad stuff, but did you find it hard to say, right, this can go in, this maybe shouldn't?
Yes, the biggest challenge, Stephen, was editing it, because everyone I meet has an Ollie Bourne story, you know, and you just can't fit it all in. It's just there's three shows, you know. This show is about an hour and 10 minutes long. It could be 4 hours long, but you know that's not going to work in theatre, you know. And I want it to be a theatre. You know, it might become a book, who knows? But at the moment, it's very much a drama. And I, you know, there you're right. You know, he was Marmite. People either loved him or hated him. People who weren't attached to Shelbourne hated him, because they could always see that he was striving just for the success of Shelbourne, and he'd walk over anybody or any club who got in their way. Having said that, he was an expert on the rules, and other clubs, I remember other clubs used to ring Ollie up and ask him for advice about rulings, you know. And you remember the famous case with St. Pat's, where basically, even though they don't like to admit this, they had what we used to call a banger, you know, that they actually ended up having two bangers, you know, and they went mad about that, but they forfeited the league because of it. But only someone like Ollie, who could get his, you know, really got into the nitty gritty and pursued this with a vengeance through the FAI, because the FAI were weak. They're weak. And listen, this play has a go at the FAI all the way through it, because of and look, they haven't improved in my estimation. And you know, they're paying lip service to the League of Ireland even to this day. And even I thought the presentation to the champions of Ireland when we won the league in Derry was a disgrace, that they didn't have a podium or a plinth or a bit of bunting, and the trophy was presented to the players on the pitch with the president of the FAI with his hands in his pockets, and he doesn't even present the trophy to the players himself. He gives it to the captain to present. I was fuming watching it. I didn't get to the game, but I was fuming at watching on the TV, thinking, you know, this is one of the biggest TV that's ever going to watch a match, because it was Damien and because it was the whole thing of Shelbourne and you know, and this is what we have to offer. I just thought it was disgraceful. I was like that back then. and it still hasn't changed. To me, that was the epitome of how the FAI think of the league, that they couldn't even arrange for two podiums to be in Tala, one up in Derry, just in case Rovers won the league. You know, they wouldn't even have the foresight or the respect to do something like that.
Yeah, I think at the time in the ground, it went over people's heads just because of the occasion, but it was something when anybody watched it back. I mean, I had friends who wouldn't really be League of Ireland people who were watching it, and that was the overriding thing, was this is like something from a Sunday league team winning. Like, yeah. It was just...
You wouldn't get it on an under-7s, seven-a-side trophy presentation in Fairview Park. Like, no. Honestly, it was so bad. I mean, I was fuming watching it on the TV, because, you know, being a person in advertising and communications, I'm thinking how important this image is now. This is what's gone out, you know, and there they are. The players are standing around on the pitch, not knowing what to do. The president stands there with his hands in his pockets. It was awful. Don't even get me going again. I guess just get so angry about it.
Well, you know? I'll ask you this, Gary. Would the League of Ireland public, we'll call them, would they have just all completely lost their heads if there was ever an Ollie Byrne Shelburne managed by Damien Duff? I thought of this today, and I just thought Ollie and Duffer together, I think, could have been either one of the greatest partnerships in the history of football, or it may have only lasted 5 minutes.
Yeah, do you know what? You could be right. It could be. It would certainly be one or the other. You know, it would be all duck or no dinner. It would either be a great success, or it would go down in flames very quickly. But you know, we at the time when Ollie was around, there was other people, you know, fighting for the space. It was Pat Dolan. I mean, he had some great ding dongs, and I remember great ding dongs with Pat Dolan, where you know we. We flooded the dugout one time on a Friday evening when we were playing Pat's, and Pat Dolan arrived up and his suit was destroyed, and he challenged me afterwards and says that I was a disgrace as a chairman of a football club, that all his clothes was destroyed. And I remember saying to him, Pat, I says, with all due respect, you come to Talca Park on a wet Friday evening in November, it's pissing out of heavens, and you're standing there dressed like a snooker player. What do you expect? You know? And in fairness to Pat Dolan, there's a couple of references to Pat, and I actually rang him and said to him, look, you're going to be, there's going to be a mentioning, and he was very magnanimous about it. He says, listen, Gary, go ahead, you know, we had a great right. Well, Ollie used to call it it's in the play. He says, we had an unfriendly rivalry, you know, which it was. A friendly rivalry or an unfriendly one. I can't remember what it is, but in the play. But yeah, and there was Roddy Collins, you know, and there was Damien Richardson, who used our former manager, so he'd have him pops up of us in the press. But Ollie was always banging the flag for the league as well as Shelburne. You know, he was a great proponent of the League of Ireland. Now, obviously, you always wanted Shelburne to be on top, but you know, he was very much he kept the League of Ireland. He kept the League of Ireland in the media. He knew how to manipulate the media. He'd even ring up Pat Dolan and say, "Listen, Pat, you know, a big game coming. I know we don't like it, but big game coming. So I'm going to say this about you, and you say that about me, and we get a better crowd," which they did.
Yeah, you know? It's interesting you say that, because I read Roddy Collins' book. And he talks about that in it, that, look, it was one of these things we knew. It was kind of like showbiz. You know, the more we get at each other, the more tickets we're going to sell, and everyone's going to come out on the right side of it. But, like, as bad as that, right? I say bad, like, as heated as the rivalry was, like, Roddy now has nothing but nice things to say about Ollie. Like, I find it fascinating that as rogue a character as Ollie was, I think other rogues loved him as well.
Yeah, and I think Pat Dolan would be the same. Now, look, you know, I know Roddy Collins very well. I'm from Cabra, you know, and I used to hang around with his brother Mick Dolan, so I know Roddy since he's a kid. They weren't exactly great friends when all this was going on now, but I mean, everything else, you know, and with the passage of time, people's attitude softened towards one another, and that's fine, and that's the way it should be, you know. I mean, when you're in the heat of battle, you're in the heat of battle, and that's what it was. You know, Ollie. Ollie was like a footballer or a manager. The match, the game meant so much to him, you know. And like I would have a golden rule where it took me a while to learn this. After a game, if we'd been beaten or didn't play well, Ollie would storm in and he'd be shouting and roaring and he'd want to do this, that and the other. He'd want to get rid of this. He'd want to get rid of him. He'd want to get the FAO. He'd want to take the club out of the league. And I, first couple of times, used to say, no, Ollie, you can't do that. And he'd erupt. So I got to know. And even with Dermot, he'd say, Dermot, just let him rant. He'd say, right, I'm taking the team out of the league tonight. That's it. We're going out. And I used to say, okay, Ollie, no problem. Back you up. And then on Monday, I'd be off, you'd forgotten about. But if I'd have said to him, you can't do that, a big row would ensue. You know?
Yeah. Well, actually, Darren Cleary interviewed Dermot for this podcast. And like Dermot tells the stories of like Ollie would come into the dressing room. Like when Dermot kind of started first, Ollie would be in the dressing room. And like Dermot said, I had to just go head on with him. And I basically told him, fuck off out of the dressing room. You're not supposed to be here. Like, again, is that another one of those things where like Ollie was such a big character, but he needed big characters to kind of not put him in his place, because I don't think that was possible, but to maybe bring him down a level or two.
Yeah, I think you needed to stand up to him and take him on. First of all, you have to remember as well, Ollie would defend his title at the drop of a hat. Like, he wasn't someone that would back down, and he wasn't afraid of throwing a few digs, you know, and you had to stand your ground with him. I mean, I remember being in the middle of rows with him and Dermot, and you know, I remember slamming the door, and the two of them were screaming at one another, and slamming the door one day and letting them at it, and then I just said, are you finished now? And they go, well, I said, because look, I said, decibels don't frighten me. I says, but you've been shouting and roaring at one another for 20 minutes and the problem is still there. Now, he's going to sit down and try and figure out the problem. Are you going to keep shouting and roaring at one another? You know, that's the way. And sometimes I got in the middle of, you know, Ollie. there was just so many funny incidents. You had to stand up to him. You couldn't necessarily back down. But I found a way of doing it. I found a way of not confronting him in the heat of the moment. I'd confront him 2 days later. I'd say, Ollie, that, you're not doing that. That's madness. We can't be doing that. That's, look, you know, forget about it. When he had calmed down, and then he'd see the light. But at that particular moment, like you're taking your life in your hands if you were going to confront him over something, you know. And Dermot got to realize that as well. I remember even when Dermot, towards the end of Dermot's first season, when it wasn't going well, he stormed in, slammed the door, and said that he couldn't do the job, and that this, that, and the other needed to be done. And Ollie was screaming at him, and I just stopped and I said, "Listen, Dermot, you know, he's actually in his book." I said to him, Dermot, you know, Dermot's book. I said, you know, you're supposed to be a hard man. I said, and you just want to take the easy way out. I said, what do you need? I need this, this, and I said, well, we let you do that. And he says, okay, well, we'll do that. I'll stay on. I said, okay. But I said, Dermot, you know, go and do your job. We're backing you. Go and do your job. Get rid of who you have to get rid of, or whatever you have to do. We have to balance the books. But at the same time, I said, now, if you ever come in again and threaten to resign, I'll sack you before you have it out of your mouth. And he said, fair enough. Have I got your back? And I says, you do. And I had to grab Ollie, you know, and say, Ollie, now, you agreeing to that? Yeah, yeah. And off he went. And then we won the double the next year. You had to have Shelbourne, for years and years, as you know, had great flair players, right? But you needed a little bit of the devil in you to be able to go and win a league, you know, and we missed that for a while. And it you know, you need a certain type of player, like you know, we had a very experienced midfield. We had Paul Doolan and we had Pat Fenlon, you know, in the middle of the park, and you know, they could manage things. They could put the boot in when they needed to. They could look after themselves, but they could play as well. And we had flair players, you know, with Stephen Gagan, and we had, you know. Even when Pat Morley was there at that time, they had a great partnership before Morley got injured. And we had lots of really good players, you know, in the team, and the Baker brothers. And then we had a good defence, good goalkeeper, a good spine in the team. But Ollie kind of recognised that. Ollie always want always Ollie loved Flair players. He loved Sherrow. He loved Mark Rutherford. He loved all those guys, Gago and all those guys. You know, but he also knew that we weren't winning. You know, and then we let's say that following year we went on to win the double, and you know, for the first time in the club's history, and hopefully we'll do it again sometime.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. The likes of a Dermot, I obviously don't know the ins and outs of how it would work, but like if Dermot comes and says, I want to sign A player, B player, C player, like, did Ollie know his football? Would Ollie bite back and say, I don't think we need that? Or, you know, what was the kind of process if you want a player? Did
yeah, he sometimes would get himself involved in things he shouldn't have been getting involved in, and I would have to pull him away from that. And I said, look, this is the manager. You have to let the manager. There were things I wouldn't agree with. I played the game, so I think I know a little bit about the game. But sometimes you just have to say, well, look, you're paying this fella to do a job. You have to let him do the job, whether you agree with it or not. And I had to convince Ollie of that several times. You know, and in fairness, if I was to say what I did best was probably managed Ollie, I was able to get into him and say, Ollie, you can't do that now. He's just a manager. You can't be doing this. You can't be interfering. You can't be like Dermot. We used to find the players, and I think Ollie used to give the money back to them till we stopped that. There was a bonus scheme in situ which I changed because, you know, I just told them that at one stage they were getting. They used to get money for a draw, money for a win, and money for a draw. And I said, no, I said, we've been paying for a failure for too long. So I said, I'll tell you what we'll do. You get X amount at the end of the year if you win the league. You get X minus Y if you come second. And that's it. As I said, we're not paying for failure. And the player said to me, what do you mean we're not paying for failure? I said, well, we give you a bonus when you win. You get money if you get a draw. We said, well, when you get beaten, you don't give money back to us. It took them a while to figure that out, but I said, that's how business works. So, you know, that's what we did, and they stayed with it, and they were fine with it. Once they understood that, you know, we hadn't been winning leagues, yet people had been getting bonuses, and I just said, that doesn't make sense, you know?
Such a different era. I mean, if you tried to do that now, the uproar that it would cause, but like that, you mentioned it, ultimately it all worked, so it's very hard to argue with something when it does work. Gary, you've been so good at your time so far. What I do want to ask you before we go, you've given us some great Ollie stories. Give me your best Ollie story that isn't in the show, because we don't want to give anything away that we don't need to.
Give me my best Ollie story that
just something that you couldn't believe happened
isn't in the show. Right. It's not in the show, but we played Glasgow Rangers, and usually what happened was the night before the game, if you were there, the home club would bring the board of directors out to dinner or out to lunch of the day, you know, depending on what it was, and the team would train on their ground. And in this case, it was Ibrox, the hallowed Ibrox. We were training, and they were having a dinner for us in the ground, in the boardroom, Rangers. And a couple of things happened that never happened before. First of all, when you might be aware of this, but when the lads had stopped training, Dermot and Pat Fenlon decided they were going to have a game of Gaelic football,
yeah,
which they did. And so the lads had a game of Gaelic football in on Ibrox. And then at the dinner, two things happened. One, Mrs. Donnelly, who was one of the owners of the Donnelly family, and a great family. Without the Donnelly family as well, things wouldn't have happened, because they were really brilliantly supportive financially and in every other ways. And she came in. I think she was the first woman ever allowed in the Glasgow Rangers boardroom. And the second thing was that I decided I was going to have to say a few words. So I sat down with my wife, and my Irish is pretty good. My wife's a fluent Gaelgar. So we sat down, and we wrote a speech as Gaelge. So I spoke for 4 minutes as Gaelge for the first time in the boardroom of Glasgow Rangers. So, and Ollie didn't know what to say.
or didn't know what to do. How he controlled himself, I don't know, right? But when, anyway, the first time I've ever seen Ollie speechless. So there you go.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you say, first time ever. It probably was the first time Ollie was ever speechless. Look, Ollie, One Love, One Life. It goes on stage. It's in the Helix Theatre. Saturday, May 17th and Sunday, May the 18th. Tickets are €37 plus booking fee. And you can get your tickets at thehelix.ie. Gary, you've been so good with your time. Thanks a million for coming on. I know everyone within the club wishes you all the best with the show. I'm sure you will have the vast majority of regular matchgoers and matchgoers from the past and just general League of Ireland people in general there. And all the best with it. Really hope it goes well.
Well, Stephen, you've been great, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to promote the show. But I even spoke to Damien about it, and Damien said, look, I want to bring the players along and the staff to see this, because we're always constantly hearing so much about Ollie Bourne. He's part of the story and the core of Shelbourne Football Club. And I just thought, look, it's a story that has to be told. And listen, Stephen, thanks very much for your time.
No problem, Gary. You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to the 1895 podcast, the official podcast of Shelbourne FC, Dublin's finest since 1895. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify, and subscribe now to never miss a new episode.